Chapter 8. This just breaking as we speak. An explosion rocked the streets of Detroit tonight as a bomb went off at 12th Street. Several are confirmed dead. So far, the police are not listing any names or numbers. We will broadcast more as the story unfolds. He turned off the television and looked back over his shoulder. Do you think it was?
I know it was, said the older man.
It's time we leave and send in the Ripper, he continued.
Yes, there will be too much heat now, and I really think it is what Death Calling wants, said the younger man.
I don't understand what could have happened. We have sent him on many missions, and he never once has done anything like this, argued the older man.
I do not think we should have sent him to kill his father.
I think that is maybe what happened, said the younger man.
Well, it is too late now. Let us leave this place and send in the Ripper and be done with it,
the older said as he left the small motel room. The night had settled in. The stars came out just above the Detroit skyline. The surrounding hospitals were a flurry of activity as ambulances brought in the dead and dying from the explosion that nearly toppled the entire building.
Jack, are you sure you're all right to leave? Roger asked as he handed his friend his charred overcoat.
Jack stood to his feet. His legs were still shaking from the force that had thrown him through a window only hours earlier.
The doctors say nothing is broken. I will be fine.
Well, the captain just arrived. Do you want to speak with him?
Roger asked as he helped steady his friend.
Yes, as a matter of fact, I do, Jack answered.
Jack, are you all right, man?
Captain DuPont, Jack said as he approached the man.
What happened in there?
Asked the captain. Agent Stone saved my life. Now I want to know what it is you know about this case, said Jack.
Jack, you know as much as I do.
Now take it easy, go home and get some rest. In fact, take a few days to rest from this, said the captain as he placed his right hand on Jack's left shoulder.
No, sir. I will not rest until I've found out how all this is connected.
All of what? What are you talking about, Jack?
Do you really think it is a coincidence that we found four dead bodies in 2 days, and then two of them get blown up? One is an FBI agent?
I believe we have a bigger picture here.
In fact, I believe the two that are now in pieces aided in the assassination of the agent and the other men on the pier.
Jack, come on, do you really think?
I'm only going by the facts, and the one big fact that Agent Stone was there, as he was with the first two murders. The FBI is entangled with this, and Agent Stone knew they were connected. You should have seen his face when he saw the bodies. He knew exactly what happened. I want to be present when all the bodies are examined.
Jack, this is not your investigation. The feds are handling it.
What do they have on you, James?
Captain DuPont looked Manson in the eye. It was at that moment Manson knew he had crossed a line.
You are suspended until further notice, DuPont said as he turned to leave the room.
Are you serious?
Carl said as he stood before the desk clerk at the police headquarters.
Well, was he hurt?
Carl asked before giving the clerk a chance to respond to his first question.
Nothing for sure is known yet. When more comes available, we will hold a press conference, the clerk finally said.
I was needing to see Detective Manson about a case. I have some information for him,
Carl said as he still sounded like he was in a state of shock.
I will tell him you need to see him, Mr. Colvin, the clerk said in a dismissing way.
Carl turned from the clerk's desk only to be facing Elizabeth Beth Stidham.
Well, hello again, Beth,
Carl said with his nose inches from Beth's.
You have discovered something, haven't you?
She said in a playful tone.
I am not sure what you are meaning. I'm only looking for a way to bring down the Van Johnson Empire.
Is that so?
Said Beth as she turned to leave the police station.
Yep, I have no interest in looking for any Russian spies.
Beth stopped. Once her feet landed on the sidewalk, she turned sharply.
Who said they were spies?
She asked.
I don't. Look, I'm tired, and if you will excuse me, I need to be heading home.
Do you mind if I join you?
Beth said as she took a step closer.
Hey, wait a minute. I haven't seen you in almost 10 years, and now you are playing this little game? I don't know why you want this story so bad, but the Beth I knew was a great reporter. She did not rely on such seedy tactics.
You're right, Carl.
She paused.
Yes, it's been a long while. I am just trying to reset myself into the journalism field once again. It was so difficult the first time around,
Beth said as she once again turned from Carl.
Hey, look, Beth. Truly, it is good to see you. But things are happening here that could be very dangerous for us all if we dig any deeper. I don't want anything to happen to you is all.
I understand, Carl, and thank you for your concern,
Beth said as she began to walk away.
If you would like, we could grab some dinner later, Carl said to the back of Beth as she continued her walk.
Are you all right, Jack? Asked Roger as he steered his car next to the curb where Jack lived.
Yes, Roger, I am fine. But I keep thinking about this whole case and how it is playing out. And the old man on the pier. Ever since I laid eyes on him, I feel as if I'd seen him before. That is one of the reasons I wanted to be present during the autopsy. If I could see him again, it might jog my memory.
Jack, it's not your case any longer. You should try and rest your mind,
Roger said sympathetically. Jack looked toward Roger and gave a halfway grin. You are right, old friend, Jack said as he pulled the door latch of the Buick. Just do me a favor and keep an eye on things at the station. I have a hunch Captain DuPont is being manipulated by the feds as well as District Attorney Sinclair.
All right, Jack. I will keep my eyes and ears open. I will stop by tomorrow to take you to lunch.
Jack patted his friend on the shoulder before exiting the vehicle.
Sounds good, old friend, Jack said as he shut the heavy door to the car behind him. Jack began his walk to his apartment building. He watched as the taillights to the Buick faded from his sight. He turned the key and made his entrance into his building. His apartment was the first door on the right at the top of the staircase. He again turned the key to enter. All the while he was thinking of where it was he had seen the man that was lying in the morgue. The man had no hair at all on his head. He carried a large black mustache underneath his nose. Jack also noticed a monocle lying beside the man's head. Not the sort of face that could easily blend in with the crowd. But Jack knew he had seen his mug somewhere. The papers, maybe. Since he was escorted by an FBI agent, he might have had a picture in the paper somewhere. Jack stopped beside his hall tree. He pushed his door shut behind him as he hung his charred overcoat on its hook.
That's it,
he thought. He was in the paper. He was an American turned traitor or something during the war, Jack thought as he began removing his sport coat. He was younger when I had seen the article, Jack said to himself as he began his walk down the small hallway that led to the rest of his apartment. Jack paused by his kitchen counter to pour his scotch. Why are the feds keeping this such a secret? He thought as he began to pour. War criminals are all over the news, so it might have been something he had seen. No, the feds wanted this one quiet. But why? What was so different that they would not even release a name? And now, several were dead, if, in fact, they were related at all. Jack walked to his phonograph and began turning the handle. And who would kill an FBI agent? That, he thought, was an even greater mystery. Once the handle stopped, he replaced the record with a Beethoven one and gave it a quick spin, and the silver tone came to life once again. Jack then started removing his holster. I need to find out the man's name, but I am on suspension. However, I am still a citizen and can look into it as someone concerned. And what of Carl? What has he found out? Jack stopped to change his clothing and put on his smoking jacket. He then found his scotch that he had left on the kitchen counter and made his way to his big easy chair. In the morning, I will head over to the library to look through some old papers. I know I have seen that man's face before.
Chapter 9. The thoughts kept running through his head.
The explosion was heard all over the place now. It would become national, and they had to leave or their involvement in this would most likely be discovered. Both men were from a different era, a wartime era, and for them, the war had never stopped. Volchek, as he was known, was a born soldier during the Second World War. He was mortally wounded during combat, and he owed his very life to the man in which he was sent to make sure was killed. He saw the body lying on the pier. He knew the man was dead. He was also sent to oversee the return of all that was involved, along with overseeing that the body was disposed of properly. The doctor could not be found, but something went wrong, and now he lay in the morgue. Volchek knew that if it was discovered on whom the doctor truly was, there would be consequences to pay, and they would be high. Volchek looked to his partner, who was sitting behind the wheel of the Cadillac. His partner was much younger than he. Mikkel. Mikkel was not his real name, of course. He was recruited after the war. He was young and ambitious. He was not without his talents. He could use any dialect or accent, and navigated through the states very easily, changing his accent from north to south with ease.
"So, how long has the Ripper been here?"
Mikkel asked as he sat staring at the city morgue building from his driver's side window.
"The whole time. We always have the Ripper here for when services are needed. But for now, we need to get Callahan's body and take him back,"
said Volchek as he adjusted his white medical lab coat.
"I think I should do this alone," Mikkel said, turning his head to face his mentor.
"And why? You do not think I can handle such a job as this?"
"That's not it at all. If you speak, they will know you are Russian, and suspicions will arise, my brother."
"Very well, Mikkel. You will speak, and I push."
"All right. We need to play this smooth, so that they will not suspect us. And what about Stone?"
"Yes, I have thought about that. I am not sure he is even dead."
"What do you mean?" asked Mikkel.
"You remember what he was told? If anything should happen, and he was discovered, to feign death, he might already be gone."
"I hope so. The quicker we end this matter, the better,"
Mikkel said as he lifted the door latch to his car.
"Let's get this over with."
Mikkel and Volchek hurried across the busy street. They both made it to the front entrance. They both walked up to the front counter. Behind the counter sat a heavy-set man with small reading glasses sitting on the tip of his nose.
"What can I do for you, gentlemen?" the man asked as he laid the newspaper down on the countertop beside his phone.
"Good evening, sir," said Mikkel, in his best Michigan accent.
"We are here to transport one of the victims from the shooting that took place the other night," he said with the best fake smile he could muster.
"Oh, the John Doe?
Yep, he sure is a popular one. I have had several people in here asking about him."
"Do you have all the paperwork in order?" said the man as he extended his hands. Volchek looked to his partner with a hint of panic in his eye. Without warning, Mikkel thumped the man hard between the eyes. Another talent of his. The man fell like a sack of rocks.
"Let's go, and hurry,"
Volchek said as he grabbed Mikkel by his elbow. The two men ran down the hall. At this hour, the place was a ghost town. Then they saw the double doors that led into the mortuary. They both pushed the doors open and began pulling drawers open. As they pulled the slabs out, they noticed that almost all were empty. Then they came to the last two. Each one pulled a drawer. They slid with ease, but showed no body.
"They must have moved them,"
Volchek said.
"Then why did he need to see papers? The clerk does not even know where they are gone?"
Mikkel reasoned as he slid the drawer shut.
"We need to leave now," said Volchek.
The two men raced back the way in which they had first entered the building. They passed the clerk, who was still lying unconscious. They pushed through the doors to exit the building. They continued to race across the city street until they reached their vehicle.
"Well, the two of you sure messed things up," said a voice somewhere near a darkened alleyway.
Volchek turned to see with whom the voice belonged.
Then a figure stepped from the shadows.
"What are you doing here?" asked Volchek.
"Doing your job," said the figure. The figure now stepped closer to the street lamp to where Volchek could make it out a little better. "I have already taken out the remains. I am now hunting Death Calling. Get in the car. You need to help me dispose of the bodies," the figure said. The figure had no signs of identity showing. He wore a large hat that covered most of his face. A black trench coat covered the dark clothing. The eyes could not even be seen. All three hurriedly entered the vehicle. The dark figure sat in the rear seat, while Mikkel and Volchek rode in front. "Take 94. I will show you where to exit," the voice said from the rear of the car.
"So tell me," began Mikkel, "why do they call you the Ripper?"
The figure looked into Mikkel's eyes via the rearview mirror. "Because I ripped the life out of my victims," the voice said. Volchek looked to Mikkel with eyes that said, "Do not ask any more questions." "I am sent to clean up messes such as this one," said the voice.
"Tell him we will finish this when we find Death Calling and return home," Volchek said as he still looked at Mikkel.
"Take this exit," the voice said.
"How were you able to take the bodies without detection?"
asked Mikkel as he ignored Volchek's looks. "I am not here to train you. I am here to do a job," the voice said, adding, "Turn into that field." The car pulled to a stop behind a large tractor and trailer. Volchek turned his head, and in an instant a blade was pushed into his temple, and he fell to the side with his head landing on Mikkel's shoulder. Mikkel, in turn, reached for his pistol, which was tucked into his trousers. But the dark figure was much quicker and shoved the blade into the neck of Mikkel. He gasped and reached to cover the hole, but the figure twisted, sending Mikkel's body into convulsions. He twisted for a full 2 minutes before succumbing to death. The dark figure stepped from the vehicle and made its way to the cab of the truck. It nodded up to a man sitting behind the wheel, and in an instant, the door to the trailer began to lower, and two men came running out. One opened the driver's side door. He then pushed a lifeless body to the side and sat in the seat. The engine rumbled to life. The man that now occupied the driver's seat put the car in gear and slowly drove up the ramp that was lying out behind the big rig. Once the car was out of sight, the rear of the truck began to lift as the ramp folded up into the truck. The second man then closed the rear doors and ran to the passenger door and climbed into the truck. The dark figure said nothing more. He looked to the man that was sitting behind the driver's seat and nodded as the man began pulling the big rig away. The figure turned away from the taillights of the truck. "We need to find Death Calling. He has been missing for far too long," the dark figure said. "Yes, I know," said a voice from inside a long black sedan that had been sitting concealed behind some trees that surrounded the property. "The deal was, I get you in, and you get yourselves out. The mission is almost complete now. Find this Death Calling character and bring him in and leave my city," said the voice. The figure stood watching as smoke rolled from the half-open window. "We will, and you will be paid for the longevity of our stay. Death Calling is one of our best. Tracking him will be hard, especially if he does not want to be found," said the dark figure. "Well, do what you must. It will be hard enough covering up that mess the first crew made," the voice said as the window began rising. The limousine pulled slowly away, leaving the figure standing alone in the field. Chapter 10. Once Jack Manson finished his morning routines, with the exception of dressing for work, he spent a little more time than usual with his coffee and paper as he waited for the local library to open up at 7 a.m. He looked at his gold watch, a gift from his wife before he left for the war. The face read, 6:45, and Manson stepped from the stoop in front of his apartment building. He glanced upward, All of the buildings seemed to be growing toward the sky these days, he always thought as he watched the hidden sun try to make its presence known around the erect buildings. Manson made his way down his steps to land his patent leather shoes onto the sidewalk. He strolled leisurely, making his way up the street toward the location of the local library. He had no idea why he was so interested in this case, especially now since he was put on leave. But he had been in law enforcement a long time, and he knew this case was much bigger than it appeared. He stopped once at the corner cafe. He loved the bagels the man and his daughter made every morning. On his day off, which was only Sunday, he would stop and get a bagel and sit down and have a cup of Frenchman's coffee as he would chat with his 20-year-old daughter about her future.
"Ah, Monsieur Manson, what brings you here on a Thursday?"
said the Frenchman, as he had already begun pouring Manson his coffee. "Just taking a day," Manson said with a grin.
"Everyone needs a day once in a while,"
the older man said with his usual chipper tone as he handed the porcelain cup of coffee to Manson.
"Hello, Mr. Manson,"
said Katrina as she rounded the counter. "And a very good morning to you," Manson said as he lifted the cup to his lips.
"It looks as though I will be leaving soon,"
said Katrina in a joyful way. "Oh, and why is that?" asked Manson, still sipping his coffee.
"She's going to France for the season,"
said her father, as he rolled his eyes upward. "Oh, and what will be taking you there?"
"A boy, of course,"
her father said, turning to wait on another customer. "Is that so?" Manson said with a grin.
"Yes, I grew up with him, and now he wants to wed me, so I will be going over, and he will be coming back with me to become an American,"
she said as she gleefully clasped her hands together. "Will he work here with you?"
"No," said her father. "He will not make his way like the rest of us have."
"Oh, Papa,"
said the young woman with a scornful look in her eye. "Well, Katrina, I do hope all of you the best in your nuptials. Now, if you will excuse me," Manson said as he looked to his watch, "I must be about my business," he added this time, handing a large coin to the young woman. Manson walked the steps of the library, and in a matter of minutes he was sitting down, looking at the archival newspapers that the library had saved from since before the war. He flipped page after page after page. There was a lot to do with the news of the day, namely the war that had ravaged Europe. Then something caught his eye in the bottom corner of the 1947 edition of the Daily News. It was him! His hair was longer on the sides, but he was still bald on top. The mustache was exactly the same. Manson knew how sentimental men could become over their mustaches. He himself had never shaved his. He also had a monocle in his right eye. The headline read, "War Fugitive Wanted for Questioning and Suspicion of Illegal Experimentation of Military Personnel." Manson then began reading the article. Dr. Eric Callahan is an American scientist that has been missing since America's involvement in the war over Europe and other parts of the world. My sources tell me that he was sent to Russia in hopes of finding ways to rehabilitate wounded soldiers, along with the Russian scientists. It wasn't long after that all contact was lost with Callahan. Many believed he was killed sometime during the war, and since he was not a soldier, this is plausible. However, all contact was lost several months before the war's conclusion. Reports surfaced that he was moved with some of the Russian scientists that were working on similar projects. It wasn't until the war's end that officials found out that Callahan had survived the war and was working alongside the Russians in some sort of robotic technology. The only known clue to this was a laboratory that was discovered during the war's end. However, Callahan was never captured, and it was widely believed that he, along with several Russian scientists, fled to Sweden to avoid capture and continue their unholy work. All that has been released about Callahan is that he had one son, who was also missing in action during the middle of America's involvement. His name was Jason, and that is all that has been released on him as well. Manson sat back in the wooden chair, staring at the photograph and rereading the article. And then he looked to see who the reporter was who wrote the piece. John Henry Thomas.
Well, Mr. Thomas, where are you now? Manson thought as he folded the newspaper. Now let's see what else you have written, thought Manson as he began flipping other papers of the same year, but found nothing. He sat for over 4 hours going through paper after paper and found nothing. Could he have only written one story about such an event? Something this extraordinary must have garnished more attention. Manson closed the final paper dated 1955. He looked around the room in deep thought. I need to find this reporter, and I think I might know someone that can help me. Chapter 11.
How could two bodies just disappear? That's insane,
Roger York said as he stood inside the city morgue.
The facts are facts. Two men came in, cold cocked the clerk, and stole away with two bodies, one being an FBI agent, said Captain James DuPont as he walked a circle around the room. Now we will have every Fed under the sun crawling all through this case, he added as he waved his chubby hands in the air. With all due respect, sir, you should have never cut Manson loose. You need him. He could piece this thing together before the Feds even land on shore, argued Roger. The captain paused a minute. He looked at Roger. And what's the matter with you? Are you a moron who always walks in Manson's shadow? Can you not figure this out? Again, with all due respect, you pulled us from this case and now two corpses have disappeared. If you would have let us move ahead with the autopsies... That's enough, York. This is bigger than even you are thinking. And I do not want Manson mixed in with it, Captain DuPont said, now lowering his voice. Look, the Feds will be coming in soon. In fact, I have no idea where Agent Stone's partner is. He was not at the apartment building, nor has anyone been able to get a hold of him. Now I want you to discreetly look into this and report only to me, he said as he looked around to make sure none of the other uniformed officers that was standing guard could hear him. And if I know Manson, he is doing the same. I had to pull him from this. I had to find a reason because there's something loose in my city, and I want it stopped. And I cannot trust anyone, and neither can you, the captain said in a low tone only inches from Roger's ear. What do you mean something is loose? Asked Roger. You will see. I just want you to be careful, York, the captain said as he moved away from Roger.
The loud knock on the front door belonging to Carl Colvin shook the man awake. He turned violently, hitting his coffee table as he rolled off his couch and onto the floor. He sat for a minute, trying to gather himself together. He looked at all of the whiskey bottles that lay scattered around his studio apartment. The knock got louder. Or was it just the headache he had from drinking too much last night? He slowly pulled himself to his feet, leaning on the oak table that held his camera and notes from all sorts of stories.
Hold on a darn minute,
he said as he staggered to his door. He quickly pulled the door open, then shielding his eyes from the sunlight that poured into the room, he could see a shadow standing in front of him. But he was not fearful of the figure because he had seen the familiar silhouette many times before. The tall fedora, the long overcoat.
I went to see you last night, Jack, Carl said.
I was pulled from the case. Have you ever heard of a reporter named John Henry Thomas? Jack asked as he walked into the cramped living quarters belonging to Carl.
Hang on a minute. Don't you want to know what I found?
Asked Carl as he staggered to his couch. I am sure it won't be irrelevant now, Jack said as he sat down in a nearby easy chair.
They were Russian assassins, Carl said bluntly.
Yeah, I figured as much, Jack said as he tossed a newspaper onto the tabletop that sat between he and Carl.
Where did you get this? Asked Carl.
The library, replied Jack.
You stole a newspaper?
Look at that article, Jack said, pointing to the bottom corner of the page.
Is that the guy?
Yeah, that's the same guy. He was on the pier with the FBI agent. I can only assume he was captured and then was brought here. And before he could testify, he was assassinated, said Jack as he pulled a cigarette from his pocket.
Well, my guy said this guy Callahan knew the assassin.
even though he wore a mask,"
Carl said, pointing to the photograph in the paper. Jack thought for a minute. "So, we have a man wanted for war crimes, being brought in by the feds, and then both are assassinated. But he was originally sent over to Russia by our team to aid the Russians in some sort of rehabilitation for war injuries. So what happened over there to make him a criminal?
I need to find that reporter."
"Why? What does he have to do with this?"
asked Carl as he looked to the name at the bottom of the article.
"Wait a minute. Yes, I know this name,"
Carl said, lifting the page closer to his fuzzy eyes.
"I didn't know him using his middle name, but I knew a John Thomas. He retired about a year ago. He didn't do anything that really stood out. He mostly worked alone and never really saw any of his work go to print. Do you think he can help here?"
"Yes. If he got close to this case, he must know more. Think about it. This is a huge deal. Scientists working with robotics and an escaped war criminal. And it only gets a couple of paragraphs in the bottom corner of the third page? Seriously, something has happened here, and it has reached our shores, and I want to speak with this guy."
"All right. I will look into it at the office."
"Good. Find out where he is now, and let's hope he's still alive."
"Okay, Jack. I will head to the office. What will you be doing?"
"I am going back to my apartment. I think I will probably be getting a visitor soon."
Chapter 12. He was sound asleep. It was almost noon, but the time mattered little to a man who lived on the streets. He turned over onto his right side and then back to his left. He stopped a few times to scratch his wiry beard. The refrigerator cartons did little in the way of keeping him dry during the rainy nights, but it was enough to break the chill from freezing him as he slept. Then he felt eyes on him. He couldn't explain it, but the rat felt himself being watched. He rolled over onto his back as he gripped the baseball bat that he kept beside him. His eyes suddenly came into focus.
"Who are you?"
he said, keeping the bat concealed under the dirty blanket that he lay on.
"That is none of your concern," the dark figure said as it stood close to the alley wall. "I need to know what you saw on that pier the other night," the figure said in a low, raspy voice.
I am not sure what you're talking about."
"Do not play with me, little man. I am going to gut you and leave you hanging here to bleed out unless you tell me everything you know about those events."
"I saw a man kill two men and leave. Then two other men came and left. That's all I know, I swear."
The figure stood silently before deciding to speak. It only took a couple of minutes.
"Who have you told this to?"
"No one. I swear."
"I want names or I start cutting body parts off."
"All right, wait,"
the rat said as he lifted his right hand to stop the figure from moving closer to him.
"I mentioned it to the mole, and no one else, I swear."
"Where can I find this mole? You must understand, I am looking for the man that committed this act of murder, and I am on a tight schedule."
"Sometimes he hangs out by Johnny Malone's place."
"Thank you, Mr. Rat. You have been most helpful, and if I find out you have been lying to me, I will come back and do all that I said to you, and possibly more. Do you understand me?"
"Yes, yes, believe me, I understand you perfectly."
"Good. Now turn over and go back to sleep, and keep that bat near you at all times," the figure said as it breezed into the darkened alley. Rat started to turn.
"Oh!"
he said, causing the figure to stop and look in his direction.
"Yes,"
the figure said.
"Mole spoke with the reporter."
The figure now turned to face Rat again.
"Which reporter?"
"I believe it was that Carl Colvin guy. He messes around down here a lot, and he talks to Mole. I have seen him myself,"
the rat said as he started to sit up.
"Thank you for that," the stranger said as a handful of green bills was tossed to the rat, who greedily grabbed at all of the loot.
Johnny Lips Malone was the quintessential gangster. He was tall. He had black hair that was creased straight back, and it was shining from every light inside his club. He had sleepy, hollow eyes, always wearing a tuxedo. He reveled in his lifestyle. He was not always head of his outfit. He worked hard to become what he was. When Johnny was only 12, he joined a gang of misguided young men. He and his friends had become regular tenants inside the city jails all over Michigan. When he turned 20, he and his friends happened upon a couple of gangsters who offered them jobs as errand boys, and that's when people started to take notice of Johnny's above-average intelligence. He could manipulate his way in and out of any situation, even when it concerned his natural enemy, the law. He caught the eye of one of the biggest gangsters in the city, Fat Tommy Marino. He took Lips, as Johnny had become known for his oversized fish-shaped mouth, under his wing and taught him everything about the business. Then, one night during a raid at the club, in which Lips now owns, Marino took a bullet to the chest when he drew his revolver on a police officer. Everyone went to prison for fighting the law, everyone except Lips. He left the scene only to resurface a year later and took control of the hottest club in town. That was almost 20 years ago. Once all of the thugs were released for various reasons, Johnny's first order of business was to kill his opposition, and now they have all been buried in various parts of the city and surrounding areas. In fact, Lips has very few enemies now. Actually, he has only one person that could impose upon him should he get out of line, and that is Manny Van Johnson, the number one crime boss in the city. Lips rises every morning and dresses in his custom-made tuxedo. He ties his tie meticulously. He then slides a comb through his greasy hair before he calls in his board of directors for the early meeting.
"Mr. Malone, word is out that Van Johnson is working with some sort of Russian mob. Should we be concerned with this?"
asked William the Brow Rogers as he leaned his elbows onto the oak conference table. Bill Rogers had been a member of the Malone gang for years. He started when he was 20 and quickly moved up the ranks to third in command. He would do anything for Lips. He would kill, steal, or manage any business opportunity for Malone.
"Don't worry, Billy. I have an agreement with Johnson, and so far he's lived up to it. Now what I'm proposing is we get more dancing and more music. I want us to be the only place in town for people to come to and get anything and everything they want."
As Lips begins his daily routine, a stranger enters the building below the boardroom. The figure strolls coolly across the floor to where the bar is sitting.
"Sorry, we're not officially opened yet," the man behind the bar said as he placed a martini glass upon a shelf.
"That is fine. I am only looking for one man. He goes by the street name of Mole," the dark figure said.
"Oh, yeah, the Mole. What do you want with him?"
"I need a question answered."
"Are you a reporter?"
"He talks to a lot of reporters?" asked the stranger.
"Well, sometimes they ask him stuff."
"No, I am not a reporter. Actually, I have something for him, and it is time-sensitive."
"Oh, all right. Then, yeah, he hangs out by the dumpster in the back," said the bartender as he motioned, using a closed fist with his thumb pointing over his shoulder.
"Thank you," the figure in black said as it made its way to the door that led to the alleyway. Stepping into the sunlight was always a gamble for the figure known as the Ripper. No one knew much about the villain, other than no one wanted the Ripper chasing after them. The Ripper stopped just before reaching the large dumpster that sat directly behind the pub.
"Hello, Mole," the Ripper said to a pair of legs that stuck out from behind the dumpster.
Mole sat straight up. His eyes flickered a few times before they stopped and focused on the Ripper.
"I know you."
"Of that, I am sure. Tell me, Mole, what did you tell the reporter?"
I told him nothing. I swear it,"
the Mole said through quivering lips.
"Now, Mole,
I highly doubt that. You see, I am sent here to clean up a mess, and you, my little rodent, have found yourself neck deep in that mess, the Ripper said, now kneeling to look Mole in the eye.
But I...
Shh! I know everything that has taken place. You see, I had a choice to make. I needed someone that I could keep an eye on things that would lead me to the ones I need to clean up, and I chose the Rat.
He sent you to me?
Yes, Mole, he did. And now I have to clean you up, the Ripper said at the same moment the door opened behind them.
What is your business with my employee? Said Lips as he stepped into the alley.
I was discussing his future, the Ripper said, not offering a glance toward the mob boss. However, as he peered at Mole through a mask-covered face, he heard the sounds of several pairs of shoes beating the pavement behind him. The Ripper let slide a blade from underneath the arm of the coat that was covering his lean body. The Rat saw the sharp tool immediately, but before he could warn his boss, blood spilled from his throat. Then the Ripper heard several weapons being pulled from holsters. Like a flash, the Ripper made his way around the dumpster as several bullets narrowly missed his head.
Hold it, you idiots! Do you want to bring the police here?
Lips Malone said.
Besides, he's probably already gone,
he added as he pointed to a hole that was underneath the fencing that ran behind the dumpster.
He killed the Mole,
one of Malone's thugs said as he knelt beside the lifeless Mole.
Yeah, and I bet I know who did it, too,
Malone said as he pulled a cigar from the case that held it inside his tuxedo pocket.
You don't think Van Johnson? Asked Bill Rogers. Yes, I do,
Lips said as he thumbed his cigar onto his cigar cutter.
And it's time we respond,
he added as his mind and words trailed off. Chapter 13. Jack took his time walking the sidewalk that led to his apartment. He knew he had a lot of work cut out for him in trying to find this reporter. The reporter had been retired for years now, but unlike Roger, he had faith in Carl, and he knew that Carl would come up with something.
Jack!
Roger shouted from the doorstep of Jack's apartment building.
Roger! I would have thought that the captain would have you mopping floors or something by now.
Really, Jack? Is that all you think I'm worth to the force when you aren't around?
So tell me, old friend, what purpose could you have in darkening my doorstep on a workday? Jack said as he fumbled for his keys inside his right trouser pocket.
The fact that I told you I would stop for lunch aside, the whole case is a sham,
Roger said bluntly.
Do tell, old friend. Come inside. I am not without information as well.
What? Really? But how?
Don't worry. And together, my friend, badge or not, we will crack this case, Jack said as he patted his friend on his right shoulder. The two sat at Manson's dinner table, revealing to one another the day's events concerning the case at hand.
So, the bodies were taken right out from under our noses, Jack said as he lit another cigarette.
Yes, and even more suspicious, the captain wants us to do an unofficial investigation,
Roger added. Well, my friend, I believe we have stumbled on some sticky flypaper here. If the man that has suddenly been taken is indeed Eric Callahan, and if the FBI are somehow involved in trying to cover this whole situation up, then we will both most likely be unemployed once all is said and done. That is why the captain wants everything hushed up.
So what do we do now?
Asked Roger as he fanned Jack's cigarette smoke from his face. We need to find the man that first reported on Callahan. He might open a whole other side that will enlighten us both as to who the enemy truly is.
And if he turns up nothing?
Then we are no worse off than where we started. Daily Newspaper. Carl Colvin pushed the door to editor Steve Dyke's office open.
I need to find John Henry Thomas,
he said as he stepped in front of his editor's desk. Steve looked up from the article he was reading.
Well, that will be difficult since the man has been dead for 5 years now. Will you please close my door on your way out?
I have a big story here.
Carl, you always have a story. Write it up, and I will decide if it runs or not, Steve said as he took a sip of his coffee.
Look, there was a Russian hitman down by the piers. It involves an ex-Russian-American trader who has been on the lam for years. Also, the FBI and our own police department. Is that a story or what?
Editor Steve Dykes looked up from his desk.
Carl, stay out of this one, he said.
Carl glared at his boss for a moment before speaking.
Are you serious? This is a huge story, one that needs to be told. It's incredible.
Steve paused for a minute before finding his words.
Carl, sit down,
he said as he motioned toward a chair that was sitting in front of his desk. Steve then took a breath.
You're right. We are the news, but sometimes things need to go unspoken. No, that's not right. Wait a minute. You know something, don't you? What happened to you? And what happened to John Thomas? All right, Carl. I can tell that nothing will keep you from hunting this down,
Steve said as he stood to his feet. He then walked to his window and looked over the small park. From there, he could see children running and playing. Soccer moms were sitting on benches together talking about their day. Some young men were on bicycles riding a circle around some weeping willow trees that had been planted to provide shade for the parents as they watched after their children.
You know, I never thought this would come back, Steve finally said. What do you mean? Carl, as much as I hate to say this, you are a good reporter. In fact, you remind me a lot of Johnny. He was the best in his day. That is, until he tackled the Callahan story. He wrote one article about that story. I thought it sounded good, so I ran it. Then he dug deeper and began writing a series of stories concerning the search for Callahan. And then he started getting calls from every agency known. No one wanted the story out. And why is that? Because of the nature of the crimes. You see, everything I will tell you will probably get us both killed,
Steve said as he looked over his shoulder to Carl.
What? This is America, not some spy novel. You can't be killed for the news. Carl, this is real life. If someone wants secrets to remain secrets, then people die. Everything I am about to tell you, I was told not to say a word. Of course, back then I was rebellious and balked at the order. And then Johnny was found dead, and I was told I would remain alive as long as I kept the story buried. Normally, I would not believe such threats, but then Johnny was found in his apartment with a slug to his temple. Suicide, they said.
Steve paused to turn back toward the window.
He found out that Callahan was sent to Russia to aid in helping Russian scientists find ways in helping soldiers recover from wounds faster. Johnny had found a few men that had been witnesses to such events. Callahan was a brilliant man, and the Russians had more in mind for him than just helping soldiers recovering. They wanted to replace arms and legs using robotic parts. It was a real Frankenstein situation.
But why would a renowned scientist even consider helping in such an insane act? Carl asked as he pulled a pad and pen from his coat pocket.
Well, one of the men that Johnny interviewed said Callahan refused at first. But then Callahan's one son was wounded during the war. His body was mangled to the point that he would be nothing more than a living torso. So the Russians involved convinced Callahan to help them build his son a new body using robotics. And that is what pulled him into the work. Then the war ended. And once both the Russian government and the American government found out the true nature of these scientists, they sent soldiers in to destroy any and all evidence that any of this had taken place. And that is where Johnny's story ended. The rest is speculation. Some say that Callahan was killed during the seizure of his labs. Others said he escaped to Sweden to continue his work,
Steve paused and looked over his shoulder to Carl once again.
And now he wound up on our shores, dead.
You knew this was Callahan?
Yes. I was contacted by the feds to keep my reporters away from the case. So now, anything you report will be a death sentence for us both,
Steve added, turning back to face the window. Carl sat quietly for a minute before he decided to speak.
Then why would the government kill Callahan and an FBI agent? That is the real story,
Steve said. This thing goes deeper than Jack thought. It sounds like Callahan was a caught man, and now it's started over again.
How do you mean, Carl?
Well, the feds found Callahan, and now the agent is dead. The scientist is dead, and the investigating FBI agent is dead. Two bodies were found, and now have been blown to bits. They are getting rid of anyone with any knowledge of this story again. However, the assassin must still be out there unless he has found a way to leave the United States undetected.
Carl, I gave this story to you. Be careful how you use it.
Carl sat for a moment before deciding to stand to his feet. His mind was a flurry of information. He had no idea how deeply this story went. Even his own employer had went against everything he believed and kept this story from the public. And for what? Fear. He was afraid. Carl didn't mind being honest with himself. This made him angry. He turned to the door without saying a word, and then he stopped before reaching the threshold. He glanced over his shoulder.
What you did in keeping this story quiet may have hurt more people than if you had plastered it on the front page.
Then he disappeared through the door.